subset of models which we in public health refer to as the real world. What I'm going to do is tell you about some of the things that's happened since we first gathered here in 1993, because since that time, the world of international public health has changed almost beyond recognition. And this is a rather good statistic for expressing that. What you see is the black line, just look at the black line for the moment, the total amount of money that was given by essentially the rich world to the poor world through time for health. In 1990, that was about $5 billion a year. About now, it's somewhere between $25 to $30 billion a year. It's an increase of more than five times. It's starting to flatten out now. But there's very little chance any time in the near future that we're going to return to the levels that we were at essentially when we held this first workshop in 1993. So the landscape, the funding landscape, has changed dramatically. And the line that you see here is both a cause and a consequence, and we don't know the balance of those two things, a cause and a consequence of events over the last two decades. What explains that huge increase in funding? What I've done is to split it up here into funding by types of health problem. AIDS in red has been the driving force and the leading force. That's the fastest rate of increase, and notice that this is an increase on a log scale here. Funding for AIDS was going up in the early 1990s at about 20% a year or so. That was being tracked by tuberculosis in yellow and malaria in red, and to a lesser extent by funding for maternal and child health, which has become more popular in recent years. And then lagging behind, non-communicable diseases, which are increasingly now becoming important for reasons that will become clear in a moment. Now that force behind funding for infectious diseases, particularly the big three infectious diseases, self-styled big three infectious diseases, AIDS, tuberculosis and malaria, there is a very strong force for maintaining momentum in that funding pattern. This was a scene at the World Economic Forum in Davos earlier this year, where these three people argued very strongly for more funding for the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. This is Mark Dybul, the director of the Global Fund, Bill Gates in the middle, you'll recognize, and this is Dirk Niebel, the German development minister, who at that meeting promised €1 billion of German funding for the Global Fund on the left, egged on by the man in the middle, Bill Gates. But despite that urging, it's clear that the increases in funding for infectious disease work internationally are beginning to slow down. And this is a set of statistics that's replicated across all of the infectious diseases, but it's a good one for HIV/AIDS as illustrative of what's going on in general. So what you're seeing in these bars is the year-on-year increase in funding for AIDS. That increase has been continuing, but you can see that it's been decelerating through time, and it has now essentially flattened out. But it will probably continue to remain flat into the near future, and particularly as we approach the 2015 deadline for reaching the Millennium Development Goals, which is what everyone now is talking about in international public health. For those of you who don't know, the Millennium Development Goals were conceived a little before the year 2000. They were implemented in year 2000. They are eight major goals for human development. One of them, number six, deals with infectious diseases. Some of the targets have been met, some of the targets have not been met for AIDS, TB, malaria, neglected tropical diseases, and so on. And there's a strong strand of thinking, like those in the Global Fund, who insist that funding is maintained for those infectious diseases. But will that happen? This is another scene that took place last year, which has mixed results for the infectious disease community. This is the scene at the United Nations General Assembly in New York. This is Margaret Chan. She's my boss, the Director General of WHO. This is her boss, Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations. And the significance of a discussion about health as it was, and non-communicable diseases in particular, is that it puts health on the international development agenda. That's what was really important from a health perspective here. But what's more ominous was that the focus was on entirely on non-communicable diseases rather than communicable diseases, because it's felt that they have been neglected in funding over the past 10 to 15 years. And the reason for that is obvious, of course. If you look at these bald statistics, about 60 million people died in the world in 2010, and this is the balance between communicable and non-communicable diseases, essentially. By the time we get to 2050, about 100 million people will die in that year. The number from infectious diseases is projected to be about the same as it is now, but the number from non-communicable diseases will be vastly greater. And that's what's behind the argument for shifting towards non-communicable diseases and essentially away from this vast amount of money that's been received by AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, and other infections. So that's the background to what I want to say mostly in this talk. And what I want to say is six things about what's happened in the last 20 years that are relevant to what we do. And then I want to add one thing at the end, which is a proposition for new work, which is completely different from what we do at the moment, which everyone in this room could contribute to well, but one or two of you might be interested in. So the first of these, you only die once. This is not the long-awaited response to you only live twice, but rather this is the rather excellent point that was made by the Global Burden of Disease Project, which has spent 20 years telling the world that our statistics on deaths actually have to add up by cause to the total number of people who die in the world each year. Now that is incontrovertible, but it wasn't the case in 1993. It was by no means the case, because everybody had different methods, they did their analyses differently, and when you added it all up, typically it added up to a lot more than the number of people who die each year. Because of course, behind the analysis was a great deal of advocacy for funding in particular disease areas. Now it does add up, and that's been a tremendous success of the Global Burden of Disease Project. But it has come with caveats. And this is one of the important caveats from my perspective, which is both a restriction and also an opportunity for us in the near future. It essentially says that when you die of one thing, not multiple things. And yet everybody knows that there is a primary cause of death typically, and there are some contributing causes of death as well. And this is just one example. An example that I've grappled with in recent years. I'm not going to describe the study in detail. I'm just going to frame the problem to explain to you that what it represents is a potentially interesting interaction now between communicable diseases and non-communicable diseases for which there is a growing agenda. And this is what I've called the vicious triangle between nutrition, diabetes, and tuberculosis, which I've spent most of my time working on in recent years. Start here. Undernutrition is a risk factor for tuberculosis. Overnutrition is a risk factor for diabetes. But if you have diabetes, you're also at risk of tuberculosis. So there's an interesting triangular relationship there. And we need to work out epidemiologically what the consequences of these different interacting factors are on a background of an aging population and an urbanizing population, which are exacerbating effects. And that will help us not only solve an important problem about a major communicable disease, but it will also help us link to the non-communicable disease agenda. So that's one of the six points. The next one, elimination fever. Now, part of this huge increase in funding that we've seen has generated a lot of confidence about what can be achieved in communicable disease control. And we've heard already about the Grenfell effect with respect to phylodynamics, and Martina spoke this morning about the Ergum effect in her area of work. With respect to malaria elimination, we can also talk about the Gates effect, because this was actually the headline in Science magazine towards the end of 2007, after a meeting at the Gates Foundation, when these two individuals said, essentially, let's eradicate malaria. No one had been bold enough to do it before then, but everybody else said, yeah, great idea, let's do that. including the Director General of the World Health Organization. So I've done the same as everybody else did. I just tracked the number of papers in malaria that mentioned eradication or elimination since the meeting at the Gates Foundation, and this is what's happened. And it's probably continued to increase then. There has been a moderation of the effect, but what has happened is that elimination talk is actually quite contagious, and it's spread to other infectious diseases as well. So TB's got the bug. In fact, TB had it before, but it was latent, and now it's come thoroughly to the fore. It's re-emerged as an important problem in tuberculosis control. So we were beginning to see posters like this, TB elimination, together we can. Well, that's great, and it's upbeat, and it's good for morale and so forth, but we need to be a little bit clear about what it is we can together do. So I've spent some time trying to investigate that and express the possibilities with respect to tuberculosis elimination. And I'll tell you this very, very, very quickly, because I've got other things to say. Basically, we're at about 1,000 cases per million population in the world at the moment. And I say per million as the denominator because the elimination criterion for tuberculosis is 1 per million population. What we've got for control at the moment is essentially drug treatment of active disease. And if you use drug treatment for active disease, this graph at the back wall of this graph, essentially represents probably the best you could do by the deadline of 2050. So we've got to go 3 logs on that scale, and we could probably get about 2 logs. So that's what you could do with drugs. The public health community will say, well, let's use a vaccine as well, if we had a vaccine. And ostensibly, a vaccine is different from a drug, but if you're using it to stop transmission, it's essentially the same thing. So if you use a vaccine, you could go down that wall, but you'll still only reduce by 2 logs, because all you're doing is the same as you were doing with the drug, which is reducing transmission. What we really have to do for tuberculosis is get rid of the latent pool. And I don't mind whether we do that with a drug, we have some drugs, or with a vaccine. Both of those things are possibilities. But in terms of the life history, we're going to have to remove the latent pool if we're going to get anywhere close to that criterion of 1 per million population. So the aim of this kind of analysis is to add some caveats, some further information about how it is together we would get to elimination. And I just want to mention polio before I leave part two of this, because polio eradication is still very much on the agenda. This was a question posed on the map drawn in the New England Journal of Medicine last year. Is this polio's last stand, the map as it was drawn? Well, no is the answer to that. India has also already fallen. But at the moment, this year, we have a rumbling epidemic in Somalia, which doesn't look like it's going to go away very quickly. Now, if we fail to eradicate polio, I think that's going to have a profound effect on the field as a whole for eradication of diseases in general. There's been talk about measles, but if we don't do polio, forget about measles altogether. No one will be interested anymore. The third thing about which there's been a huge amount of talk is that we're approaching the end of the antibiotic era. So this is a largely pessimistic outlook on antibiotics and how long we're going to be able to use them. And it's stimulated by data like this, which is regularly published. This comes from Kim Lewis's paper in Nature last year, an overview. But they all show you the same thing, which is essentially the antibiotic era was the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Very few new antibiotics for any infective agent have been produced since then. And this huge hole here in production has happened at a time of rising antibiotic resistance to many infections around the world. But in my view, the outlook is not completely disastrous. And this is something that I thought about with respect to tuberculosis. And I think the ideas which should appeal to analysts have wider applicability. Let me just express it as a cartoon like this. Imagine you have an index case that gives rise to 2 further cases, which gives rise to 2 other cases. And the green ones are drug sensitive, and the red ones are drug resistant. Now, I've called this kind of epidemic a benign epidemic, because clearly the drug resistant forms are dead end versions. They don't go anywhere, they don't generate any secondary cases. So the whole drug-resistant epidemic is really about transmission of drug-sensitive disease, not about transmission of drug-resistant disease. But by contrast, a severe epidemic would look like this, where you have sustained transmission not only among the drug-sensitive forms, but also among certain change of drug-resistant forms as well. So here we have to worry about managing both drug-sensitive and about the self-sustaining drug-resistant epidemic as well. And this is a long story, but the bottom line is this. It is that under some circumstances, it's clear that we can manage the transmission of antibiotic-resistant TB such that the rate of decline is at least as fast as drug-sensitive disease. So I picked this Estonia as an example because being part of the Soviet Union up until 1991 or so, it had very high levels of drug resistance. Once the Soviet Union collapsed and they did everything that they should have done with respect to the management of TB, they not only turned the whole epidemic round, but they actually making multi-drug resistant TB fall faster than drug sensitive disease. So that raises the general question, I think, about the analysis of drug sensitive and drug resistant disease, about antibiotic resistance in general. It need not be the case that everybody becomes resistant to drugs once they're being used. There are management strategies to overcome that. And I think it's quite interesting that in this stage that we don't have some answers to some basic public health questions, such as, if I give you $1 million to manage multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, how much of it would you spend on managing drug-sensitive disease and how much on drug-resistant disease? That's an optimization problem for which nobody has ever attempted to obtain the answer. The next is laws and data, by the way, for the world. Now, we heard about case law from Brian yesterday, but what I'm talking about here is international law and its importance for infectious diseases now and in the near future. The International Health Regulations is actually a rather dry subject on the face of it, but actually it's extraordinarily important, and in fact it has a rather interesting history too. It goes back to the cholera epidemics of Europe of the mid-19th century, but it's remarkable that up until 1969, this body of international law essentially only covered cholera, plague, and yellow fever. And it was only until recently that WHO, in the early 2000s, culminating in a new set of regulations in 2005, which came into force in 2007, the recognition that we need to deal now with a much wider range of infectious diseases, and indeed other international public health potential disasters which need not be infectious, like nuclear accidents and so forth, Fukushima being a recent important example. But that's about managing it, but there are some consequences that are important for us in this room. And one of them is the way in which the implementation of the health regulations has opened up and improved the collection of data. And I think China's an excellent example, because 20 years ago only, China was very secretive indeed about epidemics of major importance in its country with international consequences. And SARS was a very important event for China. As a consequence of that, China put in place real-time surveillance for 37 separate infectious diseases and spent an enormous amount of money doing that. The quality of that information is questionable in some instances, but the fact is that they've done that, they're collecting that information, and they're willing now to share it on an international stage. And this is an example where health goes well, well beyond the health domain, because the way China has responded to this is partly due to the way China perceives its role in the world now, which is quite different from the way it perceived it 20 years ago. This is a point that was made yesterday, but I'll make it just again. It's the obvious point that with respect to genome sequencing, we've advanced hugely in the last 20 years, and also with respect to computation as well. And I'll show it to you, if only to point out to you that those of you who don't know, this is the logo that we've used for this workshop. You'll see it on the website and in various other places. What it represents is an analysis of a tuberculosis outbreak in British Columbia. It's work by Jennifer Gardy. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2011. It's not only a pretty picture. The reason that it was in the New England Journal of Medicine was that it was one of the early nice examples of whole genome sequencing being used with traditional epidemiology, person, place, time, as we were talking yesterday, those two things complementing each other to track the spread of this outbreak of TB in British Columbia. And I think some of the things that were said yesterday are illustrated rather nicely in this diagram that I pinched from The Economist. If you're impressed by Moore's law, which represents the doubling time of computing power, or at least halving time with respect to cost here, that has been left completely behind with respect to the rate of decrease in the cost of DNA analysis. Of course, those two things together have had a profound effect for us in the field of infectious disease analysis. And this is my penultimate point, I think. And it's a rather important point. The question behind this is essentially, with the mathematical modelling that we do in the context of public health, do public health people actually believe the results that come out of modelling? And what GRADE is, if you don't know, is the now widely adopted system for judging whether or not evidence that comes from epidemiology is good enough to make decisions in public health. And that is really critical with respect to modelling. And you could ask, well, where does modelling fit into this framework here? This framework, like most epidemiological methodology, is really about doing the experiment that you'd like to do, but you can't actually do because it's not ethical. So this is a difference, referring to what Mart and Don were saying yesterday. This is a difference, of course, between human epidemiology and veterinary epidemiology. You can't just stick a couple of kids in a sheep pen, I don't mean goats, I mean children, and use them to find out how to fill in the elements of your matrix. You can do that, but we can't do that. So what we have to do is devise methods that come close to experimentation. They're essentially a surrogate for experimentation. And modelling is, of course, a body of techniques, but it doesn't figure on the radar screen of GRADE at the moment. And yet, this is how public health people are making decisions. So I've put modelling question mark down here. The quality of information goes, of course, down from randomised controlled trials, which are real experiments, down to case control observations. So, but where does modelling lie on this? Modelling could go down a few grades because of the indirectness with respect to the nature of its argument, or it could go up a few grades because of the way in which we can use models to overcome problems of bias and confounding in studies. But at the moment, modelling doesn't have a place in this framework, and that's an important problem. So the last thing I want to say, and this is the suggestion for future work, which is quite different, and it comes from my perception of working in the World Health Organization, because back in 1993 or so, the relationship between WHO and the rest of the world looked like this. We interacted with the national disease control and donor agencies that dealt with diseases domestically and gave money to the rest of the world, and of course we dealt with the rest of the United Nations organizations. But what's happened in the interim is this. Just in 20 years, and this is a consequence of that and a cause of that massive increase in funding that I showed you in the first slide, you have huge numbers of NGOs of various kinds and foundations. You have lots of international finance agencies and various international health partnerships. This is a very crowded environment these days. From an analytical point of view, these institutional dynamics are essentially a birth-death process, which has predominantly been birth in the last few years, but will inevitably have some casualties. From an analytical perspective, it's completely virgin territory, institutional dynamics, but potentially an important one. So it's on the table for any of you who are interested. Thanks for listening.
Any questions for Chris?
You have the data that communal diseases become less important and non-infectious ones become more important. Would you get the same direction if you look at the numbers of life years saved? Or if you prevent diseases.
Yeah. So if you didn't hear the question, when I was talking about trends in communicable and non-communicable diseases, I was really referring to mortality. And the question is, do you get the same pattern if you think about diseases in terms of years of healthy life lost, usually called disability-adjusted life years? And the pattern is essentially the same, with some minor variations, but the broad picture is the same.
Chris, could you comment on the role of pharma in all of this, particularly the relationship between local pharmaceutical industry and the MNCs?
Yeah, it's a very good question that deserves a long answer and a long discussion. But the relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and the public health has been standoffish for an assortment of reasons. That, I think, is a general recognition in recent years, is that that's counterproductive, and that what we need in public health is to not oppose what the pharmaceutical industry is doing because we don't like the bad things they do. Rather, we've got to harness the best of what they can do and channel their energies through investment in research and development into solving the problems that we know we need to solve. And the central agencies like WHO have a key role in that, because pharmaceutical industries typically don't know what the patterns are in public health. We know what they are. And we can actually help construct the market which is relevant to pharma. And I think Nim will touch on this in a moment, some work that he and I have been doing, which is about making sure that we don't have a market failure with respect to the diseases we're dealing with, but we resolve that by essentially creating a market that pharma can respond to. But I think, Nim, you'll talk about
that. Do you want to make a quick point?
Yeah, Chris, slightly turning your talk on its head, taking away from, I think, the thrust you're trying to push it towards, and thinking about the international health regulations and their impact across a range of diseases. And this question is based on a social science study carried out looking at diagnosis of emergent diseases in rural Ghana, that we haven't yet published. But do you think that there's a danger that the broad implementation of the international health regulations with a focus on well-recognized diseases makes it harder for us to systematically detect emergent or largely unrecognized diseases?
No, I don't think it does, actually, James, because, and we have a beautiful illustration at the moment with MERS, today's equivalent of SARS.
Can I add to my to my question in resource very poor settings?
Well, but the settings like Ghana might themselves be very resource poor. But the point about the international regulations is that Ghana would be responsible. Let's say there's some new outbreak in Ghana. Ghana is responsible for telling the world about any threat that has international consequences. But the other part of the bargain is with the international community to respond to that. And certainly that's the feeling within the World Health Organization, is to gather together the resources that are needed to combat that international threat. It won't all be positive, but I think there are positive aspects to it.
Thank you.